Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. Delicious and smooth tequila, meaning harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
We talk about food. About music with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one of your hosts, Darren Bresnitz. Summer is here, which means we are heading to the farm. Sit down with owner and chef behind Corman Farms, Kieran Hales. Corman Farms is part of the legendary Ziegerman's Group, which you might know for their famous deli in Ann Arbor. We talk about Kieran's teenage years in the English and European kitchens, his growth as a chef, and some of the stories that, well, probably would not fly today. And talks about his journey to the States and how he became part of the Ziegerman's family. It's a great conversation. Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your hosts, Darren Bresnitz. It's summertime, and that means we are getting out into the gardens. We head to Corman Farms to sit down with owner and chef Kieran Hales. Corman Farms is part of the legendary Ziegerman's Group, which you might know for their incredible deli in Ann Arbor. Kieran shares his teenage tales of being in English and European kitchens, what eventually drew him to growing his own food, and how he wound up becoming a member of the extended Ziegerman's family. It's a great conversation, pitch perfect for things that are popping out of the garden. And then we're going deep, and I'm saying deep, into the Brooklyn archives to hear the tropical sounds of the Colombian group South Cathedral. It's a legendary performance, a legendary chef. And here we go on the legendary network, Heritage Radio, Snacky Tunes. Sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Falling gracefully down this path.
Kieran, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Thank you so much for taking the time out of the garden to sit down and chat with us. We really appreciate it. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for getting me out of the rain. I brought my British weather to Michigan today. It is a little drizzly out there today.
You know, I have to say, coming from Altadena, the last few days and even last week, we had some rain. It was gray mornings and I was just living in it. And now it's 90 at 10 a.m. But I said, I'll take some gray coverage. I'll take some coziness.
Yeah, I'm waiting for it to snow that one last time in Michigan. Got to love our Michigan weather.
Oh, right. With that, the, what is it? It's like fake spring, last snow, then spring.
Yeah, you got to plant your plants at least once and then dig them out of the ground and put them back in the greenhouse at least once or twice in the year. It's not a real grow season.
Well, that's how you get all that flavor, that constant stress and frustration and movement. I think Franklin wrote about that in the Almanac, if I remember correctly.
Yep. That's true.
So the thing that is amazing about your career is how young you started. And I know it's interesting because, you know, we always get people's bios. But to say that you started your career at 13 is definitely one of the younger ages I've seen for the word career be associated. Normally it's like, oh, you know, their mother or their grandfather or had to passionately pass it on. But do you really feel that you started your life's works, your journey at the tender age of 13?
Yeah, I moved to London. So I come from a tiny little village of 300 people, and I was living in, you know, the biggest city in the world, most expensive city in the world at 13 years old, working. So I did one of the last modern apprenticeships in Europe, and I was there. I was pulling 60-hour days at 13 years old, 6 days a week. And on my day off, I would do a little side hustle at another restaurant in order to get employee meals so I didn't have to spend any of my few pennies they were paying me at that point.
I mean, I remember those early days where I started working in food media, sitting down to lobster or French fries or literally anything that wasn't anything coming out of my pocket. And I went, I think there's something here to this.
Yep. It was when I started, I had actually, what's fun about coming on and chatting with you is my career started as a classically trained bassoonist, right? So weird place to begin in the music world. And I was sitting at the Royal Air Force Base in London, starting the first ever like air training corps band. And I was with the first bassoonist and he's like, yeah, you're going to play the same 100 pieces of music for the rest of your life. Sure. I came home from that and I was like, well, I don't want to do that. And I was in a music school at the time. It was paid for by a scholarship from HSBC Bank back in the day. And my music teacher's like, oh, you should go talk to the home economics teacher. She thinks you're great. And she sent me off to do an assessment at the specialized chef's course in Bournemouth. And I passed it and off I went. My mother was an amazing cook. And I just thought that it was the best thing I could possibly do. And yeah, I passed. I was the youngest person to be approved into that program. And I moved to London, which is wild. Like coming from really butkus nowhere in the UK.
Shout it out. What's your hometown? What's your home village?
My village is called Stoke Gabriel. On my address, you have to put near Totnes because we were so small. You had to be near the nearest town. But there was 300 people. I was the only kid in my year when I first started in my elementary school. There was probably only about 300 people in the village. It was crazy small.
You know, you're talking about, and you said the end of an era, the last of this sort of time of young vocational work with little to no, I don't want to say it's not safety precautions, but it was like, yeah, it's just, I'm 13. I'm working 16 hours a day, 6 days a week. And everyone's like, oh, Kieran's out there just absolutely doing it. Could you sort of give us the mindset of that time of why that was a path forward, I guess, a path out of your village. And also something that was just more acceptable for something that parents would even sign off of. Cause I find it hard pressed today for any parents to say, yeah, go to London at 13. We'll see you in a couple of months.
Yeah, I've got a 9-year-old, so to think my son could go live in New York City right now would make my brain fall out. I don't think he could make it to the end of the road safely most days of the week, is how I feel.
Yeah, of course.
So I had lost my father at a pretty young age, couple of years.
I'm so sorry.
No, I all things happen. I'm where I am today because of all the things that happened in my life. It was not a good thing in the moment, but I wouldn't be here, wouldn't have met my wife, wouldn't have had my kids, wouldn't have had the career I had. And I think some of it was spurred by that, is how I describe why I'd made the move. My mother signed off on it because she saw the joy that it brought in my heart. I think that honestly, I found what I wanted to do at that really tender young age. And she was 100% behind it. And she was at home in that small village with my older sister. And I left and went to London. It terrified the heck out of her. She would try to call me every day, and I'd probably respond once a week with a telephone call. I would tell her how great it was, but I'd be coming home crying from work and living in a youth hostel in Earl's Court in London. But I still loved it. That rush of working that line was amazing. I mean, I was standing on boxes to work the gravity slicer. I stood inside the tilt skillets to clean them at work. There was a lot of illegal things I probably did at that young age.
I'm sure. It's just from what you listed right there, I was like, I don't know about this.
And it was, I gotta tell you, like the camaraderie of the people around you back then, it was the last wave of the old school chefs. I mean, you would get burnt on the wrist if you did something wrong. You'd get very heavily disciplined. I speak about it fondly now. It was not fond at the time.
Right.
But it built that bond between me and probably about 12 people that I still know to this day. They're nicely spread across the world as well. And I don't know. I didn't have that in my life as a child. I didn't have a best friend. I didn't have this large group of friends. I built that from that community in that kitchen, that very first kitchen I worked in.
I mean, that structure, that guidance, that, you know, those figures of discipline, of knowledge, but also being accepted that there comes a bit of a corporal punishment when you make a mistake. I mean, that doesn't exist anymore, that type of foundation. And it's interesting to go at an experience like that when you're a teenager versus maybe in your early 20s or even your late teens, when a lot of people would finish up school and say, I'm going to go into the chef world. I'm going to go get into this more hierarchy of classical European UK type of cooking. To have those fundamentals come at you at such a young age, there's no way it doesn't change your life forever.
Yeah, I think I was it makes you very accepting of it. It was the only way I knew. It was the first time I moved out of my house. You know, it was the first time living alone. But I'd also say, like, I said my father passed away at a young age. I was dysfunctionally looking for a father figure. And, you know, executive head chefs, they are great father figures, right? They are disciplinarians.
They are a type of father figure. They are a type of father figure.
Yeah, I found it very quickly in a lot of different kitchens. It's made me a very different person today because I went through a lot of those very old schools. I got to work with Paul Bocuse in his restaurant in Burgundy. I will forever feel very privileged to do that. There are loving memories that I have of some of the meanest people that you could meet on earth, and they're yet some of the kindest people when they need to be. It's a good thing.
It's that yin and that yang, that of the fundamentally, it's a service industry where you are creating these unbelievable experiences and taking care of your guests, while on the flip side, behind the kitchen doors, sometimes taking it out on the people who are providing that experience. So it's understandable how those two sides of a person can exist in the same executive chef.
Yeah, it's like I said, the fact of having a 9-year-old, I would never ever want him to go through any part of it. I just think that it's wild that my mother let me. I forever feel very privileged that she put me out in the world and let me do it. I think many a parent, even back then, wouldn't have done it. And we're talking like, you know, mid early 90s when that all took place.
I mean, that was really the last end of this era before people started looking at how are we treating people? Is there a different way forward? And I think it's easy. And again, I didn't experience this, and I can see how you can look back and say, yes, it was bad at the time, and I can laugh about it, but understand that some things had to change. Some of the things are like, oh yeah, we probably can't do this anymore.
Oh yeah.
To individuals.
There was some very bad things that happened back in those days, and they were not good. They're not how we should treat people and how it should. I have to say, it's like that generational change when you talk to your uncles who's in their 90s or your grandparents, you know, they are stuck in that boat. Those chefs were stuck in that boat. They had been trained religiously in it. I was definitely the last of that transition out of it.
Now, how did you make your jump out of school, the Royal Academy of Culinary Arts, into different kitchens? I know you worked for Paul Bocuse, but getting to that kitchen is not just a, hey, I've graduated and I'm going to go work for old chef over there in a 3-Michelin-star restaurant. What was your road to getting into some of the top kitchens of the world?
This sounds really horrible to say. It was the old boys club. They just passed me around. I would be like, I'd be on the fish station in a kitchen and they'd be like, yeah, you need to go to Munich. You've got to go to work in Tantris. You need to go work in their meat station for the next 6-7 months. And then I get on a plane, put all of my bags with me, and I travel. And I would just move where the next head chef told me to move. I had never applied for a job in my life until I had applied to come over to the United States because of visa application reasons. Beyond that, I'd been given to one chef to another chef the entire time. I was super lucky. I was, you know, when I graduated, when I finished my culinary program, I had no special skills. I was lucky where I landed. I'd been lucky along the journey. Lucky the people I got to work with, but it was, yeah, it was the old boys club. It's really sad to say, but it was just, and it really was a boys club as well. They would just pass chefs around back and forth. You know, I'd see some of the same faces, you know, 2 years later, making a different circuit around the, you know, top 100 restaurants in Europe.
Did that draw you in? Because you immigrated to the U.S. in the late aughts.
Yep.
And obviously there's some people who went into that boys club European system and said, my goal is 3 Michelin stars. My goal is, or if not that, then a bistro or some version of what you would think of a stereotypical European restaurant. Nothing wrong with it, but it's just like, this is what I know. This is what I train for. This is what I open.
Yep.
At what point did you say, maybe not for me? Or did you try it and you went, this isn't for me?
I got broken with a really simple question. We were working in a 2-Michelin-star restaurant, and I was with this really senior chef de partie, and I was the sous chef, and we were just talking about where the food came from. And I couldn't answer enough of his questions. And I could cook amazing food. I could plate beautiful food. I knew the process, but I didn't know where things were coming from. And I got so removed from the supply chain of where the food had come from. I took a huge change in my career probably about 6 months after that. I went to work for a few smaller restaurants where I could be literally, you know, suppliers would be coming in the back door. And I mean, like somebody, I worked in a small independent fish restaurant in Burnham Market in the UK. And literally, there would be these old guys come with their wheelbarrows of potatoes, literally 100 yards up the street. And we would go out on day boats. We know where the fish was coming, the meat was coming. You would think in those very high-end restaurants back then, you knew everything about where it came from. It was a super secretive part. Until you got to the very, very upper echelons, did that information get disseminated to you? You just knew they brought the most expensive thing. You knew they brought the best. And I couldn't live in that world anymore, not knowing. And it changed my trajectory. I will also say, living in Europe and living in that many different countries, I like the American customer base. This sounds really funny, but like, I love, even if it's fake, and I know this sounds terrible, even if somebody says,
have a nice day.
Have a nice day. Yeah, tell me I want to have a nice day. I do want to have a nice day. I don't want to grunt from across the screen. And like the other thing was, like, we would have customers when you serve them that they'd assume they knew everything about the food you were serving them. The American client base is so interested, so intrigued. It was like the new world. And it really was. Like, to me, Charlie Trotter's restaurant books, when they came out in London, I remember being at a catering show in central London in Earls Court when those books came out. It felt like this place where you got to explore, where customers really cared about things. They were doing the first like Relais Gourmand restaurants where guests would spend a week with you in the hotel and they would spend time in the kitchen. And like, what? These rich people who are paying for these Michelin star restaurants want to hang out with me too? Like, that sounds great. And that definitely felt more like it was happening over here than anywhere else. And I know, like, even as a Brit, the American dream's pretty nice. Like, I don't think I would be where I am now if I hadn't have come over here. Like, to get your foot in the door of purchasing something, to actually be an owner. I know people who are the chef and the owner of a Michelin star restaurant and still only own 10% of their business. And that is not cool. Like, that is not okay. I feel like if you're going to work that hard, you should be working that hard for you and your family, because it's taking you away from your family. The American dream lets you do that over here.
I love it. All right, well, Karen, let's take a quick musical break. We're going to hear a song from the archives, and then we're going to get back and talk to you about winding up in Ann Arbor at the farm, at the Zingerman's Roadhouse, and a few other things. And so here we go. Song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.org.
And I get lost in the thrill sometimes. Oh, I get lost in the thrill sometimes. Knowing real well I'm just a jolly rancher in her drink. Mortal slander you assumes now what I think. I get lost in the thrill sometimes. Oh, I get lost in my thoughts sometimes. Yes. No, I won't stop letting her go. No, I won't stop letting her go. Running with the feeling till the feeling's gone, that's what I thought. Twisted little chatter on the bathroom floor. I can't stop, I get lost in the thrill sometimes. Oh, I get lost in my thoughts sometimes. No, I won't stop letting her go. No, I won't stop letting her go. No, I won't stop letting her go. No, I won't stop. Exciting than the edge of that table for one. For a second, the temptation fell more than just fun. I get lost in the thrill sometimes. Oh, I get lost in the thrill sometimes. Letting her go. No, I won't stop letting her go.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are here with Kieran Hales. And the American Dream is calling. You have stacked an incredible amount of experience in European kitchens, going around, learning everything, and then realizing that you needed to know where your food was coming from. Why couldn't you do that? And I understand the American Dream and the ownership part of it, but was there no opportunity to have a farm, be a chef, do that in Europe? Was it some type of setup that only exists in America?
I think so. Like, to me, I'd worked in a couple of restaurants where I tried to buy in. I had a decent amount of money saved up.
Sure.
Thankfully, my mom had taught me well to save every penny I could. And I probably gathered about $100,000 back then, probably about 120,000 pounds. It was a lot of money. I mean, that was a lot of money for my age. I was probably in my late 20s. And I still couldn't buy anything in. Every door got slammed in my face. And I remember talking to a lot of my suppliers, a lot of the people I was interacting with that I'd known for a long time. And they're like, yeah, you are not going to get in that door unless you've got $500,000, and that's about it. And it just didn't feel like there was a way out. The small independent restaurants, the mom and pop places, they wanted to stay mom and pop. They did not want to let you in the door as well. I worked for a lovely guy, Fish's Restaurant in Burnham Market. It's closed now. And I would have loved to have stayed there. I think the reality was that that was their whole income. There isn't a way to sell a bit of it and give you. There's only just enough to give you out in that world. And so I think for me, I had been chatting with a guy called Randolph who owns Neil's Yard Dairy. And it sounds really creepy now, but like when I started in London at 13, he was one of the first people I met, and he would take you out to fancy restaurants. Sounds very bad in today's world.
Yes.
He would literally like take out commie chefs and we'd stay real connected. And I'd known him for years. He knew Ari, who owned Zingerman's and started the deli in 82. Interestingly, the year I was born, 1982. And he had said that I really needed to meet this guy. There was an opportunity that I could actually get my foot in the door and become an owner. And Zingerman's had this way to have a path to become an owner with blood, sweat, and tear equity, not just money. And I felt that really compelling way to be over here.
So for those who are not familiar with Zingerman's, can you explain what it is? I mean, as a restaurant, as a business model, as an institution?
Yeah. So the deli was started in 1982 by Ari and Paul. They founded it in a part of Ann Arbor that was downtrodden and no one thought was a good idea. They became wildly successful. It took them a while. They settled into what is a really great Jewish deli. It was pretty small. They slowly expanded over time. At one point, they were driving to Detroit to get their bread every day. One of their employees, or one of the people they knew, Frank Carollo, would be one of the people going and getting that bread. And they had the opportunity to turn Frank into his own business and open Zingerman's Bakehouse and be able to bake bread. And that opportunity opened up the opportunity to have a community of businesses. So we're not a franchise. We're a community of businesses that share the same name at the top. So Ari and Paul are little co-owners of all of our businesses. But we interact with each other in ways that make sense. And now there's a bakehouse, there's a coffee company, a candy company, a training organization. My wife works there. We had Zingerman's Roadhouse, which is where I joined the organization, which is a full-service restaurant. We've got Miss Kim, which is a Korean restaurant. For us, there's a mail-order business that ships food all around the country. It was started by individuals. So you didn't say, I would like a bakehouse. We found a person who's really compelling and they want to start a business. And that is a really fun way to have that business be successful. So rather than say, wouldn't it be great if Zingerman's had a brewery? Because we don't have a brewery.
Right.
And no one's come along and stayed long enough to make that side of that work, right? And so for us, the businesses that are there are being driven by people. And I don't want to say it, but like me and my business partner, Tabitha, if we left the organization, Zingerman's Coleman Farms might not stick around. It might be a business that's just us. Hopefully we've created a business that there's someone in our business that wants to carry it on. We've had some transitions of people in our organization. So Jason Restrick just became the managing partner of the bakehouse. That was where Frank Carollo had opened it. And he just retired. And Jason took up the mantle with Amy Emberling. that's a pretty beautiful thing to be able to be in that spot. And it creates some longevity. We've got the support of other people to help us. Opening a business as a 30-year-old kid, and I was a kid at 30 years old, I definitely don't feel that way now, I'm 40. I was very thankful for that larger support of people that have been through something similar. Every business is still new. There isn't this magic pill that Zingerman's gives you to make you successful. You go through all the same births and deaths of troubles and strife that goes on in a business as you're making it begin. I think that what it has is there's people that have been through it with you know, in a similar spot that you can lean on for help and support.
You know, it's one thing to get into the business world. It's also another thing to have that revelation about understanding where your food comes from. It's quite another thing to run a farm for arguably one of the most famous food institutions in the Midwest, if not America. How did you go from the idea, because I believe you were the executive chef and then you got into the farm. What was that transition like? Did you start with a small plot of land? Did you have a rooftop garden and then you just kept growing and growing and growing?
So I illegally smuggled in my mother's rhubarb from her back garden when I first came over here. No one stopped me. So clearly it was okay. Everything was fine. I started when I first started at the Roadhouse as the chef. I brought over 23 different cans of beans and chili paste and chutneys. And I wanted to do that. I didn't even want to be cooking anymore. I wanted to go into canning and jarring and I wanted to grow the things for it. I started to write that business model and realized you had to make tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of those things to make any real money. I was like, well, that doesn't sound as fun as making, you know, a batch of 1,000. That's way more fun. And so over time, one of the things we do at Zingerman's is we write visions, very powerful visions of where we want to be in the future. And so one of the hardest things I've ever done, I'm terrible at writing. My grammar and spelling is what renowned within the organization as being bad. I sat down and tried to answer the question of what I really wanted. And for me, as much as it was about growing the food, it was being connected with the land of where I was and be able to go to perfect. And so we do weddings at the farm for 2 people to 300 people. We'll grow vegetables they've requested us to grow. We'll grow things that are meaningful for us. We've got people that have brought their seeds from their grandparents that came over in the Second World War that we're continuing for them. We grow vegetables for like different restaurants in the area. We've also created a community of other things that happen on the farm. We've got a carpenter that rents one of our businesses, our buildings for us within our business. We've got another farm that works out of the back, Tamchop Farms, with us. We've got a florist that rents the space. I honestly want a little bit of a commune out there if I was given my full druthers.
Wow, full commune. Outdoor shower, rise with the dawn, swim with the ducks.
That sounds lovely. Maybe not today.
Maybe not today. So, you know, it's great that you have such expansion in the portfolio at Zingerman's, and not just you, but I'm using like the royal you, that you're able to grow and produce different things for different restaurants or different businesses. But obviously you don't have infinite land. You don't have infinite resources of farming. How do you decide what to grow, how to evolve, where to push? And then are there things that you have to grow?
Yeah, I think the things that we grow tend to be the things that other people aren't, the things that are more difficult. We do not, if we put Zingerman's name on a farm stand at the end of our road, we would put a lot of other farms' sales down. That is not our desire. We do not want to grow everything that Coleman Farms uses or the other places are. We're growing some of the quirkier, more difficult, more challenging things for us. We're growing things that our guests can interact with straight away when they're on property with us. I think for us, it's the enjoyment of growing rather than having to have a high production. It isn't the thing that has to pay the bills every day for us. We have a venue that we do weddings, and that's the bit that pays the bills. And so being able to have that farming side of our business is the way to have that connection with the land for the guests that start their lives with us. I mean, having people get married with you is a very, very meaningful moment in their lives. And sometimes we'll have planted a plant for them 2 years in advance, knowing that's what they want. Oh, yeah, that's some fun stuff we get to do. And so I think the things we choose to grow sometimes might surprise people how simple they are or then how complicated they are. Things that people don't want to grow. I don't know. Seltzer is not something that's grown a lot out there in the world, especially for me.
It is not.
I love seltzer. Oh my God, I would eat seltzer every day if I could. And like,
I did not think we'd be talking about seltzer on today's show, but here we are talking to a farmer. Yes, okay.
We also grow lovage. My Auntie Wendy, who passed away maybe 3 or 4 years ago, when we were going to the pubs when I was a kid, she would put smashed up lovage in her brandy to make it taste good. But then I learned that lovage was like the original thing you put in your Bloody Mary. And like, who the heck knows that? And like, to me, I'm sold at that point. We're growing lovage till we go blue in the face at that point.
Oh my God. I love it. I love it. So go on.
No, I was going to say it's the stories behind them that are compelling. Again, I got a 9-year-old kid. And when he comes out, it's not why you're growing this. It's more about, hey, this is Auntie Wendy's lovage. This is why we grow it. This is my mom's rhubarb. This is Auntie Sue's strawberries that we've got out here. Like, those things are real. I can tell you they're not the best vegetables. There are better vegetables in this country for sure. But they are the most meaningful. They taste better because we're connected with them and what's going on.
Does it help that you already have a buyer for what you're growing?
Oh, yeah. Every day.
Yeah.
Farming is hard. It is hard.
I was going to say, it's one of the hardest pursuits. So it's like, as you get deeper into the supply chain or the fundamentals of what you really need to make a restaurant work, at least from the food side, it's like you get to farming and most chefs go, no, I don't work that hard, even though I just worked a 15-hour day.
Yeah, you can tell me I'm a hobby farmer. I don't want to ever be called a farmer because those people, they work really hard. I got to tell you. I mean, I came from that community. Like I said, I came from a very small part of England. It was all farming around us. When our teacher didn't want to teach us, we would end up at a local farm planting or picking something for free on their days off. It was good for them.
You might be the only one whose experience there actually benefited them later in life.
Indeed. I ran away from it to go to the big city, and then I've run back to it now. I tell you, like, I think
it's so funny how that works, doesn't it? Isn't it?
Oh, and like, I want my kids to experience it. And I don't know if I'm putting them in the same cycle or not. I have no idea anymore.
Yeah, you'll probably know in about like 20 years when they're telling their own story as themselves as a brand, and they go, my father put me into the fields at a young age, and that's why I'm doing this farm of my own.
I think that like watching new farms come online and a lot come and go, sadly, is the naivety of what they want to grow and what it means to grow something. Frank Carollo, one of the bakers at the Bakehouse, has historically kept coming back to the same bread to make it better and better and better, right? To go deep, really go deep to improve something. I think a lot of what happens in farming, we only get one season to grow a potato, right? You only get one season to test something new or to adjust it. And so if it doesn't go well, sometimes people move right on and don't try, you know, the next season to try and adjust the next place. Or they'll grow the things that are meaningful for what they think the community wants them to grow. You know, the amount of zucchinis and kale that will appear on your back dock on a regular basis as a chef in a kitchen. And it's like, you haven't sat down and talked with the chefs. You need to sit down and talk with the chefs. And that becomes important.
Do you still see yourself as a chef? Do you still? Yeah. I mean, obviously, you're calling yourself a hobby farmer, so I'm not going to say you went all the way to the farmer. But is it still at the core at the end of the day, you're just, I mean, don't kill me for this analogy, but it's like if you built your own bassoon and you're playing this, you're building your own ingredients. You're growing what your tools are in the kitchen.
Yeah, I would describe it better that way, that I wanted more control over the tools that I had. I could tell you, like, the reality of my life and the people in my kitchen and my business would tell you this. I'm like their maintenance guy. I like to change motors on extraction fans that have gone bad. Like, I got to take something apart and make sure that it's really broken before I can move on with my life. Like, I'll redo tiling. I'll do some plumbing and some electric later in the afternoon. I'll jump in the pond to change the sump pumps that are in those. Like, to me, it's all one in the same. If you don't understand all those moving parts of a business or the life cycle of that business, and I mean that as all the moving parts of like a body, then you're not really owning the whole thing. And I like that the staff can see me downstairs dealing with a plugged toilet, outside dealing with the veggies, or cooking, you know, a 7-course meal for very high end guest the very same day.
Wow. I mean, that's great. And it's great to see that you've touched every tacit of it. So what are the moments like now when you've grown something, you've grown over a couple seasons, it started out as something that wasn't perfect, but you perfected to it. And then you've taken that ingredient and made it a new dish, new drink or something like that. How often are you getting to see the customer experience and then also learn about what they're eating?
It is almost weekly, which is kind of the best thing about what we do is not being a restaurant in that we're a event space, right? So
sure.
We get these very close connections with these people. Half the time they want us to come out and talk about the menu. And so I get to literally interact with them. We're in an open kitchen. I've got the farmhouse is from like 1837. It's completely open to the guests to walk in and interact with us. We sometimes have their kids help us pick the vegetables for their crudité boards. Sometimes they'll come out and help us weed or plant things months before their weddings. I mean, they get to experience the journey with us. We have people that don't want us to do that, and it's a very transactional relationship, and that's okay.
Fine.
But you get these other people that are like family to us now. And our family has grown over the last 9 years of Coleman Farms being there. We have farm babies now, right? Like there are these families that have grown up with us. We've got a vision that goes out 100 years for the trees that we want to plant. We talked about our Christmas tree farm that we want to grow out there. So my kids have something to do to pay for their college because it might not be the money that I'm making.
You probably make more of a Christmas tree in America than a potato. I'm just gonna say. On a one-to-one ratio, I'll put it that way.
I think that those connections are why I love what we do, the things that we grow. And so when you ask like that thing that comes all the way through, I gotta tell you, I'm still always disappointed. There's always that growth potential of making it better. One of our sister businesses is very into Toyota lean principles, like continuous improvement. And he's completely burnt my brain forever. And so like continuous improvement is there's always better and you can never sit on your laurels. And that's like being the eternal apprentice chef in a kitchen. And I love that feeling, like to always be naive, to always know that you don't know and that there's no win. And I always thought there was a pinnacle to get to in the industry, like you said at the beginning about becoming a 3-Michelin-star chef.
Sure.
It's not true.
I'm with you.
When Marco handed back his Michelin stars, Marco Pierre White handed them back and said, nope, don't want those. I want to go run a pub. That's trying to get connected with where things are. And I think those things are the way we as people need to define ourselves and not by the accolades that come with things. I've seen too many people get their accolades and that bubble is burst and there wasn't anything. You get really excited about having it and keeping it, but then there's nothing. It's kind of hollow when it comes at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, I think you're doing it for the family and for the farm and just for your passion, and it's your life's work. And I appreciate you sharing some of those insights because it's really inspiring. If people want to learn more about the farm or even come out to visit or order anything from the farm, where can they go? How can they get connected?
Yeah, this is where my marketing department comes after me with knives, right? You want to go to zingermanscoremanfarms.com. There's a shop there. We make English pies. It was one of the only traditional foods in London. There's all of our information. There's recipes on there as well. If you end up on Instagram or Facebook, we've got cooking videos from my house that we share, things that we love and passionate. COVID taught us a lot of things that we could record those things and find the time. We find no time now that we're back to busy. But yeah, come to our website, come out, come see us. There's nothing stopping you. We've got, you know, nearly 27 acres for you to romp around on the farm.
Amazing. Well, Kieran, thank you so much. One last question. What's your bassoon playing like these days? Do you ever get back to it?
My son, I think, is better than I am. he can still play it, so that's good. I probably only get back to it maybe 3 or 4 times a year. I rented it out for free to somebody that needed it a couple of years ago, and they gave it back to me fully finished. So all the corking, all the keys had been refinished for me because it had been through the wars a little bit back in the day.
Oh my God. Well, listen, thank you so much. Congratulations. Hopefully get my family and I out to the farm one day. Next time we're over in your part of the world. We have another song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on hrn.org. Thank you.
closer. You claim the best is to come.
I'm Chava Perivan, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainably managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Salt Cathedral, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Thank you guys for coming in.
Thank you.
Super excited to have you DJing the barbecue as well. I want you to introduce yourselves. Say what you do in the band.
My name is Nicholas.
My name is Juliana.
Cool.
And
you jam.
Yeah, we are the band.
We are the band.
We are the band.
How'd you two meet?
Everything.
We met in Boston while we were in college.
B-10.
Where'd you go to school?
Berkeley College of Music.
I went to BU.
Yeah.
Did you eat at Anna's Taqueria?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, great. All right, cool. See, everyone eats at Anna's.
Yeah.
Don't trust someone who lived in Boston and didn't eat at Anna's.
It wasn't that good, though.
See?
Ooh. I did eat there, but it was
Well, thank you
good.
So much for coming by. All right.
How did you two meet and start writing music together?
We had, like, classes in common. So we started, like, we met each other and just... doing some ensembles, and
we're both also like from the same place. We're both from Colombia. We grew up like 10 blocks from each other.
But you didn't meet till Boston.
Met the same people, went to the same like college in Colombia, and we never met.
Are you the same age?
Kinda, like yeah,
yeah,
1 year.
Yeah,
man, that's so crazy.
I mean, how big is the scene in Colombia that you could have missed each other?
Well, it's an 8 million people city, but we did work.
Well,
we were
like
in the same scene. Yeah. No, we totally could have met. Like, yeah. I knew some of his friends, he knew some of my friends. So,
right place, right time.
Yeah.
So, when did the maybe like the first kind of like etchings or inklings of Salt Cathedral kind of start to come into reality?
Well, it was maybe 2-3 years ago. We started touring all across the U.S. and then we started writing in New York. We came from Boston to New York to write our first EP. And then from there, like we took it seriously, And so we started like producing and writing and just touring.
Is it all self-produced?
Yeah.
Yeah, completely self-produced.
That must be nice. You can be on the road in a hotel room and just be like, let's bang out a song.
Yeah, exactly.
Computers, yeah.
Yeah, computers, man. Making music anywhere these days.
Yeah. Let's hear a song. Yeah.
Sure thing.
What do you guys want to play first?
This song's called Holy Soul.
Okay, great.
All right, Soul Cathedral here live on Snacky Tunes. Great. That is awesome. So you guys are working with the Latin Alternative Music Conference this week. What are you doing with them?
We did a couple of shows, Tuesday, Wednesday,
nice,
and Thursday.
In New York?
In New York.
Cool.
Wednesday, Rough Trade with the this guy from Tijuana called Maria Jose, and then we played with Denver from Chile.
Oh, nice.
Wednesday we did our own show, and Thursday we were doing some light shows for this Colombian band called Balancer.
Light shows?
Light show.
Yeah. You were doing the lights?
Yeah.
Oh, multi-talent. When did you start running lights? What is your light show game like?
It's synchronized with the music.
Yeah.
And basically, it's just a bunch of strobes and a lot of colors.
A lot of fog.
We have what's your fog game like? You know, we have like a fog machine, like tons of lights. And we have these like installations through which we like project the lights, like two big moons. We one day got into it. We're like, we need to set up our own vibe, whichever room we go into. So I think we learned that. So now we're like, our friends are like, can you do lights for us?
So do you control it? So like, is your whole show also controlled, the lights, everything controlled by you from stage?
It's MIDI synced.
That's fine.
But when we do it, we control it.
Hold on a second. When you just said MIDI sync, like that's not, no, like that's not okay.
No. Like it's pre-synced.
No, I understand, but that's still very impressive. It's still,
actually, I wish that you could sing and run the lights manually. I would be more impressed. Yeah. I would be more impressed. That's so awesome. That's just like a really great way to know that no matter what venue you go into, it's just going to be your vibe.
You set up a mood.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. No, I don't want to be disrespectful.
It's okay. So I know that you were been on tour recently. Where are some of your more favorite places to play around the country?
Austin.
In the country?
Yeah. Or we can say world, if you want to go global.
I think our favorite place to play was Japan.
Okay. Why was that?
Because of the food.
The food.
What'd you guys eat?
And the crowd.
Tonkotsu
everything. Everything. It was really nice. And especially... They know how to party.
Really?
Oh my god. They party till like 7 and keep drinking, and then they eat ramen at like 8.
I don't see any problems with that.
No problems with that. So now your blood is like one part blood, one part sake, one part pork fat. Yeah.
Was there like anything in particular that like obviously everyone's like, oh, ramen, but one particular food that you had that you didn't know existed previously that just kind of blew your mind?
No, it was more like, for example, we had whale.
Okay.
And that's illegal here, so...
Yes. How was it?
It was good. It was really fatty.
Could you see why? Never mind.
I'm not eating that. That's such a bad joke.
All right. Do you guys want to play another song for us? Which one's this?
It's called Good Winds.
Cool.
Thank you.
Awesome. So now you guys are working on a new record. Yeah. How is this going to differ from the previous release?
Better songwriting. Better
it's
production.
More influenced, yeah. It's more influenced by like more Latin rhythms and like dance music.
Awesome.
Yeah.
How do you make better songwriting?
Just doing it. You just practicing.
Yeah. Study writing other more people songs. Who wrote better songs than you did.
Who are some of your influences? Or who have you been studying?
Joni Mitchell.
You're the second person to bring her up this week in like an influential way that I would have not expected. Yeah. One of my coworkers sent it out, like, listen to this on Monday to be inspired for the week. So I can feel that.
She's amazing. You can't get tired of her.
Well, the thing is that Joni Mitchell, she's like really creative, like with her forms. Mm-hmm. You know, she adds like two bars in somewhere else. And she was doing a lot of like pop songwriting with influence with jazz. And she was doing a lot of stuff like that, you know. And she's like... She had different eras, you know, so you can learn a lot from their records. They're so different.
Do you have a particular Joni Mitchell song to point people to?
For sure, A Case of You.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
That's the obvious one.
A classic.
classic one.
All of Blue, I think, is just mind-blowing.
Yeah. So we want to make sure we have time for one more song, but where can people come see you play live this summer? I know you just got off a slate of shows, but... Tour, local?
Not right now.
We don't have any shows right now, but we're always, like, putting them up, you know. They sometimes come short notice because we're, like, in New York. So if they follow us on Instagram, we're always, like, on there telling people, you know, like, we play at Rough Trade Babies.
Love Babies.
Like,
love
a lot of babies. I love Babies. It's the best place.
They really nailed it. They're friends of ours. I've been here before. I really feel like every time there's a show there. But they're also one of the places, like... What am I doing this week? I don't have any plans. I'll just go to Babies. Because you know one of those two of those four bands on a bill are going to be good.
Yeah. Or the DJ or just the bar. It's always fun.
When that screen lowers down, the whole place turns into a dance party. That's a good time.
When Dan Deacon played there and they just opened up the windows and just turned the whole place into like, everyone's like, they designed it so well.
They did.
A lot of little tricks.
And the lights are
amazing.
The lights are incredible.
Well, thank you guys. And if people want to come see you DJ, they can come to the barbecue on Tuesday night. If you just go to heritageradionetwork.org, you can see the poster. Thank you to Contra. Thank you, / Wild Air.
Thanks to Jay Strell. Thanks to Brian as well for helping set this up.
Sure. And thank you so much. Shout out to Joe. Shout out to Anna. Love you too.
Yeah. Shout out to Summers in Berlin.
Summer's in Berlin, one last song before we got to get out of here. What do you got for us?
Yes. It's called No Ordinary Man. It's from our upcoming record.
All right.
Unreleased track.
And we'll see you all on the Domino Records Bow Party tonight.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Bye, guys.
Bye. Mm-hmm.
Is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.